Disc 7.
As rainy morning wore into afternoon and the fighting bogged down, the Marines continued to take casualties. Often it was the corpsmen themselves who died as they tried to preserve life. William Hoops of Chattanooga was crouching beside a medic named Kelly, who put his head above a protective ridge and placed binoculars to his eyes just for an instant to spot a sniper who was peppering his area. In that instant, the sniper shot him through the Adam's apple. Hoops, a pharmacist made himself, struggled frantically to save his friend. "I took my forceps and reached into his neck to grasp the artery and clinch it off," Hoops recalled. "His blood was spurting. He had no speech, but his eyes were on me. He knew I was trying to save his life. I tried everything in the world. I couldn't do it. I tried. The blood was so slippery. I couldn't get the artery. I was trying so hard. And all the while he just looked at me. He looked directly into my face. The last thing he did as the blood spurts became less and less was to pat me on the arm as if to say, 'That's all right.' Then he died." The near misses were nearly as ghastly, especially the ones that resulted in other deaths. Donald Howell's buddy, Walter Gust, took a piece of shrapnel in the side of the head. It did not fracture his skull, but for a moment he was incoherent, flailing around. Howell and some buddies tackled him and were taking him to a corpsman when another round exploded, blowing Howell into the air and nearly taking Gust's arm off. The Marines reloaded Gust onto a stretcher. Then a machine gun burst killed the stretcher bearers and ripped apart Gust's other arm. "I was watching this," recalled Howell, "and there was nothing I could do about it. Walter survived. He lived near me for years. I was the best man at his wedding." By late in the bloody afternoon, the conquest of the mountain seemed within the Americans' grasp. Marine discipline and the sacrificial bonding of ardent young men was prevailing over concrete, steel, and thick volcanic rock. But the Japanese, even as their ingenious fortifications crumbled or were scorched hollow, were not quite done with their own desperate resolve. As the 28th continued to inch forward, Navy observation planes above the battle radioed that a swarm of Japanese had emerged from inside the mountain and was forming up for the dreaded Banzai attack. Within minutes, American planes were swooping in low to strafe the area. Their tremendous roar and the concussion of exploding rockets reverberated among the close-by Marines. Finally, the planes banked and vanished, and for a few moments the battlefield was silent, tense with expectation. It was Sergeant Mike Strank, with the 2nd Platoon now on the left side of the line, who broke the spell. Leaping to his feet, the Czech-born Marine bellowed, "Let's show these bastards what a real Banzai is like. Easy Company, charge!" With that, the bone-tired, battle-scarred Marines got to their feet and once again slogged forward into the line of fire. To the right of the 2nd Platoon, the 3rd, commanded now by Boots Thomas, joined the foot race to Suribachi. Boots Thomas was the next hero to shine. With rough terrain stalling the tanks some 75 yards to the rear, the 20-year-old Floridian saw that his riddled unit was grievously exposed once again. In the thick of battle, a daring solution came to him. He sprinted back through fire to the nearest tank and, still out in the open, directed its fire against the stubborn pillboxes. Then he dashed back to the front to exhort his men. A bit later, he headed for the tanks again. He repeated this action several times. His example paid off. The 3rd Platoon virtually annihilated the very enemy that had been massing for devastation of its own. As darkness on this triumphant, bloody day was setting in, Thomas himself identified the weak spot in the defensive line and personally led the breakthrough to Suribachi's steep flank, waving his knife aloft in victory. Boots was recommended for a Navy Cross, which was awarded. Suribachi had not fallen, not quite, not yet, but victory now seemed inevitable. The wet day ended with the 28th Regiment poised in a vast semicircle around the battered volcano's base, gathering its strength for the finishing assault, expected to come the next morning. For Easy Company, it had been a day of grievous loss and historic valor. For its day's work, the badly decimated unit would receive a Medal of Honor, 4 Navy Crosses, 2 Silver Stars, and a number of Purple Hearts, one of the most decorated engagements in the history of the United States Marine Corps. These honors were paid for in blood. Casualties for the day amounted to 30% of Easy's strength. Easy Company had actually moved a little too far and too fast for its own nighttime protection. Dave Severance's boys had penetrated past some active Japanese units and spent the night isolated from the battalion. They huddled on a strip of jagged, rocky terrain at the southern base of Suribachi, the roaring surf of the Pacific below them on the opposite side. Dave Severance set his command post as close as possible to the mountain so that he would have a line of sight up its flank. In the late evening, searchlights from the offshore destroyer escort ships revealed something that looked like Japanese moving into view above Easy. As the ships began tattooing the volcano's flanks with 40-millimeter shells, Captain Severance moved his command post back 30 yards to the water's edge for a better view of the volcano's slopes. It was a good thing he did. The next morning's light would reveal that the original CP site lay buried under several tons of rocks from a bombardment-triggered slide. Low on ammunition and food, Easy's troops munched what was left of their chocolate bars and waited for yet another dawn on Iwo Jima. The Marines had paid for their advances across all fronts on the island with heavy losses. Official casualties for the battle now stood at 644 killed, 4,168 wounded, and 560 unaccounted for. Howland Mad Smith himself was sobered by what he had witnessed. Watching the Marines cross that island, he later told a newspaper reporter, reminded me of the charge of Pickett at Gettysburg. But the horrors of this day's fighting did not end with the darkness. Just as dusk fell, an air raid signal alerted the ships offshore. To Don Mayer of Portland, 19 then, it made a spectacular show. Every ship was firing thousands of tracers, he said. It was more beautiful than any 4th of July you've ever seen. To the boys on board the Task Force ships, the sight was not quite so beautiful. Cecil Gentry, a radio operator on the USS Lawrence Taylor, could not move when the order to hit the deck came from his captain. I was transfixed, he said. I just stood there. One plane flew right over my head. I could see the face of the Japanese pilot. You could see the fear of death on his face. His lips were pulled back over his teeth. This pilot immolated himself against the USS Bismarck Sea, adjacent to the Lawrence Taylor. Four of the ship's own torpedoes detonated in the concussion, and the great ship exploded in huge sheets of orange flame and rapidly sank, its bow turning straight down as it slid under the rough waves laced with rain. The men of the Taylor managed to rescue about 120 of the 800 crewmen from the water. Other rescuers managed to save hundreds more. Cecil Gentry recalled watching corpsmen amputating sailors' legs with razor blades, saws, and meat cutters from the galley. But more than 200 were lost as the Japanese planes strafed the waters. Back on land, the chilled, hungry, and exhausted Marines faced a different kind of nocturnal menace. Fear of infiltrators, the fear of the dancing shadows, had preoccupied the Americans on each night since D-Day. On this night, the fear took on more justification than ever before. On this night, the madman in the haunted house unleashed all his ghouls. Prowling Wolves was the name that General Kurabayashi had given his teams of stalking, crawling night murderers. Now, desperate to save their mountain fortress, they crept out in force. At around 9 p.m., up north with the 26th Marines, Thomas Mayers of the Bronx was surveying the terrain from his foxhole when a flare exploded in the mist. It illuminated a horrible sight, accompanied now by screams, two Japanese slashing two helpless boys in the next foxhole with bayonets. Their names were Krall and Dortch. Mayers and his buddy leaped to their feet to take action. One of the wolves wheeled and hurled a grenade at them. It was a dud, but it struck the other Marine in the head and knocked him unconscious. Mayers squeezed off one round before his rifle jammed. The predators were now advancing on him. The 20-year-old private groped for his hand grenades. The Japanese were so close that throwing the explosives was out of the question. Mayers ripped out their firing pins, scattered them at the edge of his foxhole, and ducked. The enemy soldiers howled and collapsed, their legs full of shrapnel. Mayers climbed from his foxhole and with his knife cut their throats. Then he sprinted to the other foxhole. Krull was dead. Mayers shouted to the lacerated Dortch, "Do you have any guns?"
"Yes," the boy murmured. "Krull has a .45 in his shirt."
Mayers snatched the weapon. It was slathered with Krull's blood and would not fire. Two more Japanese were now upon Mayers. He rolled a few more grenades at them and ducked through the explosions and then finished them off with his knife. Thomas Mayers received a Navy Cross for his actions. He has never forgotten the moment-to-moment sequence of that bloody episode. Krull, a freckle-faced Irish boy not more than 18 years old, was screaming as he died. And his words would forever haunt Mayers.
"Mom! Mom! He's killing me! Mom, he's killing me!"
Chapter 10 D-Day Plus 3. It wasn't a matter of living or dying or fighting. It was a matter of helping your friends. Corpsman Robert DeGusse. A lull after the hellstorm of the previous day, and a terrible day for capturing a mountain. The heaviest and coldest rain since D-Day lashed at the surviving Marines. The surf, whipped by 20-knot winds, rolled in on 9-foot crests. The rain made a black stew of the volcanic ash underfoot and waterlogged many of the Americans' weapons. Easy Company, clinging wetly to its isolated post, began D-plus-3 by nearly getting wiped out by friendly fire. The Navy sent their carrier bombers in to bomb the volcano, as Captain Severance recalled it. The pilots must have seen us as live Japanese targets and started dropping 100-pound bombs on our positions. Severance ordered red flares fired to warn the bombers off. No one could find cartridges for the rifle grenade flares. The bombs fell nearer. Radio connections to battalion headquarters had gone dead. More explosions. Desperate for relief, Severance put in a call to Harry the Horse himself on the colonel's private radio frequency. "Red Wing 6," the captain shouted. "This is Bayonet Easy 6. Friendly planes are bombing the hell out of us. Over." Back came the courteous reply from one of the colonel's radio men. "Bayonet Easy 6, this is Red Wing 6. You are not authorized to come up on this frequency. Out." Luckily for Easy Company, Lieutenant Colonel Chandler Johnson happened to be standing near the radio operator. He personally saw to it that the Navy planes were diverted before they caused any casualties. Now that it was wide awake, Easy Company prepared for a day of consolidation as the American ground troops waited out the weather. Lieutenant Colonel Johnson ordered Severance to reorganize and resupply his unit. The captain sent a patrol around the southern base of Suribachi to seek a link-up with the 3rd Battalion and to probe for enemy soldiers in the caves along the base of the volcano. As the day progressed, sporadic firefights broke out around the volcano's base on the west side, Easy's peerless flamethrowers, clicking death in 6-second bursts, scorched out some caves on the south and east sides. Suribachi was surrounded now by American troops, and the invaders' heavy equipment operated almost without resistance. Tanks, howitzers, and other big-bore weapons slammed hot rocks, as though it were a target on a firing range. Battalion officers moved their command posts up to the brush line at the base of the slopes. Amphibious vehicles churned back and forth between the beaches and the front, bringing food and ammunition at will. Demolition specialists converged on pillboxes and bunkers with a vengeance, relishing their payback for the volume of slaughter those emplacements had dealt out. Sometimes a concealed Japanese soldier, seeing that his position was overrun, would make a sudden, desperate break through the Marines for safety. His fate would usually be an M1 rifle bullet. One Japanese officer brandished his samurai sword as he made his break for it. A bad mistake. A Marine, seething with 4 days' worth of grief and terror, grabbed the blade out of the samurai's hands and sliced its owner to death with it. The Marine's hands were badly lacerated, but he held onto the sword as a souvenir. Many of the enemy simply remained in the ground. Their muffled voices and the sounds of their movement added an eerie note to the mopping-up exercises. "We could hear them talking and moving right under our feet," one Marine recalled. "Right under what we thought was solid rock. We'd dig down and find a rafter. Then we'd lower explosives or pour in gasoline. Then they made a lot more noise. The combat-weary boys dealt in various ways with the memories of what they'd seen and done. Some talked to chaplains. Some lost themselves in their duties. For Ira Hayes, it was his edgy gallows humor that provided the shield against utter darkness. As Easy Company regathered itself at the base of Suribachi, Ira grew absorbed in shaping little mounds of earth with his hands. To Joe Rodriguez, they looked like fresh-dug graves. And in fact, that seemed to be what Ira intended. When Franklin Sousley wandered past, Ira made a show of playing taps. Then he said to the Kentuckian, "This is just in case I'm not around when you get it." Franklin just kicked the mounds over, Rodriguez recalls. The impending conquest of Suribachi was far from the only action on Iwo Jima. To the north, the main force of Marines had been battling with equal valor and sustaining equally severe casualties. By the end of D+3, the volcano known as Hot Rocks was surrounded, except for a 400-yard gap on the western coast. Surrounded, but still dangerous. Some of the defenders who remained were still determined killers, and no one knew when or where one might emerge with a grenade or a machine gun. As night fell, however, the Japanese themselves greatly reduced that danger via a highly uncharacteristic action. Voluntary abandonment. It involved only half the remaining force, but it amounted to an acknowledgement that the mountain fortress was finished. The order was given by Suribachi's commanding officer, Colonel Kanehiko Atsuchi, as 150 soldiers burst from the mountain in a desperate race to join up with the forces to the north. They were cut to pieces by Marines, only too happy to deal at last with a visible enemy. Only about 25 made it through the gauntlet. When they arrived at the headquarters of the Japanese Navy Guard, their reception was not much better. The captain in charge, Samaji Inouye, accused their lieutenant of being a traitor and unsheathed his sword to behead the man. The lieutenant meekly bowed his neck, but a junior officer stopped him before he could swing his blade. Captain Inouye then collapsed in uncontrollable sobs. "Suribachi's fallen," he moaned. "Suribachi's fallen." Earlier that afternoon, the American command had reached the same opinion, in a different frame of mind. Harry the Horse Liversedge received orders that the mountain be seized. Harry paid a visit to Colonel Johnson at his 2nd Battalion headquarters and issued a terse command. "Tomorrow we climb." Chapter 11. So every son of a bitch on this whole cruddy island can see it. I saw some guy struggling with a pole, and I just jumped in to lend them a hand. It's as simple as that. Doc Bradley. It hulked above them still, before daybreak on the fifth morning, this primitive serpent's head that had struck them down in swaths. Amputated from the body, bombed, blasted, bayoneted, burnt, Suribachi at last lay silent after 4 days of being killed. But was it dead? Was the grotesque head finally a carcass? Or was there venom still inside and strength to lash yet again? There was only one way for the Marines to find out. They would tread on the head and see whether it writhed. February 23, 1945, dawned cold and stormy like the other days on Iwo Jima. But by mid-morning, the rain had stopped and the skies were clearing. Hot Rocks glowed early. Navy planes lit it up with napalm at dawn. It was a sheet of flames, remembered Donald Howell, who had relaxed with House Madam before the invasion. "An amazing pounding," agreed Max Heffley. But around 9 a.m., the pounding stopped. The serpent's head lay mute and enigmatic, and the dangerous probing by foot began. The pugnacious Colonel Johnson, wearing his trademark soft cap with the visor flipped up, called for 2 4-man patrols to reconnoiter routes up the northern face of Suribachi. Only Fox Company's patrol made it to the top. The leader was Sergeant Sherman B. Watson. The others were George Mercer from Iowa, Ted White from Kansas City, and Louis Charlo from Montana. Tensely grabbing at roots and rocks for balance, braced for ambush at every step, Watson's patrol felt its way upward amid the smoking rubble. The serpent lay dormant. The hostile fire never materialized. With the courage and discipline born of combat, Sergeant Watson and his boys ventured all the way to the volcano's lip and even risked a look into the crater, a satisfying mass of wreckage, before scrabbling back down to the base and reporting to Chandler Johnson. As he observed Sergeant Watson descending, Colonel Johnson calculated he could risk a larger force and grabbed a field telephone. He cranked it to full battery power and yelled an order through the fuzzy wires to Dave Severance, who was bivouacked with Easy Company, still hugging the rocks on the southeastern point. "Send me a platoon." Severance surveyed his troops. The second platoon, Mike with Harlan, Franklin, and Ira, was off on a probe around Suribachi's base. The first was encamped several dozen yards away. So Severance chose the survivors of the third, Doc's platoon, the closest to Colonel Johnson's command post, to become the first American platoon to climb the mountain. The ranks of the third had been shredded by combat, so Severance augmented the platoon with 12 men from his machine gun platoon and several 60-millimeter mortar section men. This increased the platoon's strength to 40 men. Harry the Horse Liversedge himself picked the leader, First Lieutenant H. George Schreier, Severance's executive officer. Liversedge had known Schreier when they served in the Marine Raiders together, admired his combat experience, and valued the lieutenant's knowledge of how to direct air, artillery, and naval fire by radio. No one was ready to believe that the serpent had finished striking. Just before the 40-man patrol began its climb, Chandler Johnson turned to his adjutant, Lieutenant Greeley Wells, and asked Wells to hand him something from his map case. Then Johnson called Lieutenant Schreier aside and gave him the object. "If you get to the top," the colonel told Schreier, "put it up." What Johnson handed the lieutenant was an American flag, one that Greeley Wells had brought ashore from the USS Missoula. The flag was a relatively small one, measuring 54 by 28 inches. Dave Severance never forgot the wording of that command. He didn't say, "when you get to the top," the captain pointed out. He said, "if." The platoon made ready to start its trek. I imagine my father looking around for his buddy, Ralph Ignatowski, Iggy. A Marine Staff Sergeant named Lewis Lowry, a photographer for Levenek magazine, asked permission to come along and record the ascent. The boys in the unit glanced upward, measuring what lay ahead. It was Boots Thomas, appropriately, who got the unit moving. "Patrol up the hill. Come on, let's move out." "I thought I was sending them to their deaths," Dave Severance would later admit to me. "I thought the Japanese were waiting for a larger force." As the 40-man line snaked upward, gained altitude, and grew visible against the near vertical face of the mountain, it attracted attention. Marines on the beaches and on the flat terrain to the north turned to watch. Even men aboard the offshore ships put binoculars to their eyes to follow the thin line's winding trek. Nearly everyone had the same thought. They're going to get it. The men on the march shared this sense of dread. Harold Keller happened to glance at the two stretchers being sent along as the platoon fell into line. "I thought to myself, we'll probably need a hell of a lot more than that," he recalled. Doc Bradley, shouldering his Unit 3 bag, was another who wondered how many would return alive. "Down at the base, there wasn't one out of 40 of us who expected to make it," he told an interviewer not long after the battle. "We all figured the Japanese would open up from caves all the way up to the crater." And my father had an additional concern. All the way up, I kept wondering, how the devil was I going to get the casualties down? Don Howell marked the slow, wary progress. "We inched our way up," he recalled, "blowing caves as we went. We'd see a cave ahead of us, pull the pin on a grenade, and throw it inside." As he passed the cave entrances, Howell could see that they were strewn with empty sake bottles, the Japanese liquor of choice, and bags of plain rice. Phil Ward never forgot how the platoon wound its way cautiously, single file. There was no trail, and there was a lot of blasted rock. We zigzagged our way up. We had to get on our hands and knees and crawl a couple of times. We had heavy weapons, and two men had heavy flamethrowers on their backs. We were all scared. One of the flamethrowing Marines was Chuck Lindbergh. Even he was braced for instant bloodshed. We thought it would be a slaughterhouse up on Suribachi, he later said. I still don't understand why we were not attacked. As the Marines climbed, they beheld Iwo Jima for the first time from the perspective of the Japanese. Spreading below them in panorama were the landing beaches and the armada at anchor in the ocean, the narrow neck they had secured at such cost, the enemy airstrip, and the rising terrain of the main bulk to the north, and the small figures that were their comrades gazing back up at them. How close, how intimate, how eerily serene it all must have looked to them. About two-thirds of the way up, Lieutenant Schreier sent out flankers on either side of the main unit for cover. We were tense, said Robert Leader, thinking the enemy would suddenly jump out or one of us would step on a mine, but it was completely quiet. Not a shot was fired. It took us about 40 minutes to get to the top. Sergeant Lowry documented the ascent with his cumbersome camera. At one point he asked a Marine to unfold the flag so he could get a photo of it being carried up. The patrol clawed its way to the rim of the crater at about 10 a.m. Looking down into the bowl, the boys of the patrol saw devastation. Japanese anti-aircraft guns fused together by the heat of American bombing. Twisted metal, pulverized rock. Robert Leader could not suppress a smile of glee as he spotted two large drop tanks, jettisoned fuel tanks from Navy planes. I got a chuckle thinking of the Japanese watching those tanks come down, he said. Leader's next impulse probably expressed the attitude of every young Marine who would face the mountain. I said to Leo Rozek, Gee, I have to pee. Rozek said, Great idea. So we both peed down the hill. I said, I proclaim this volcano property of the United States of America. The spit and polish Hank Hansen took this in and was indignant. Knock that off. Who do you think you are? Leader had a ready answer. I'm an American citizen. Hansen changed the subject. He relayed a request by Colonel Liversedge that Leader, as the platoon's unofficial artist, make sketches of everything around him. Leader set to work. Then Boots Thomas came up with an order of his own. See if you can find a pole to put the flag on. Leader set aside his sketchpad. He'd bound his drawings together with surgical tape supplied by Doc, and he and Rozek scoured the rubble at their feet. The Japanese had constructed a catch system for rainwater on the crater's surface, and fragments of pipe lay scattered about. Rozek, rummaging in the mud, found a fragment of usable length. He and Leader lugged it upright. The two discovered a bullet hole in the pipe. The rope could be threaded through that. They manhandled the pole, as Leader put it, up to where Thomas was waiting. Then, knowing that this was an important moment that would be photographed, the patrol's brass took over. Lieutenant Schreier, Platoon Sergeant Thomas, Sergeant Hansen, and Corporal Lindbergh converged on the pole. They shook the folded flag out and tied it in place. Lou Lowry documented the proceedings with a steady succession of camera shots. He moved in close, suggested poses, cajoled the boys into self-conscious grins with his patter. Louis Charlow joined the four. At 10:20 a.m., they thrust the pole upright in the gusty wind, the first foreign flag ever to fly over Japanese soil. Lowry, wanting added drama for his shot, motioned to Jim Michaels, who crouched dramatically in the foreground with his carbine. Then a glitch. Lowry shouted, Wait a minute, to the posing Marines. He'd run out of film and needed a second to reload. Lindbergh scowled and grunted at him to hurry it up. Men holding flags were easy targets. With a fresh roll of film in his camera, Lowry called for a final posed shot. Hansen, Thomas, and Schreier gripping the flagpole as they stiffly circled it. Lindbergh and Charlow watching them from a couple of paces off. Michaels adding drama in the foreground with the gun. As Lowry clicked this exposure, an amazing cacophony arose from the island below and from the ships offshore. Thousands of Marine and Navy personnel had been watching the patrol as they climbed to the volcano's rim. When the small swatch of color fluttered, Iwo Jima was transformed for a few moments into Times Square on New Year's Eve. Infantrymen cheered, whistled, and waved their helmets. Ships offshore opened up their deep, honking whistles. Here was the symbol of an impossible dream fulfilled. Here was the manifestation of Suribachi's conquest. Here was the first invader's flag ever planted in 4 millennia on the territorial soil of Japan. Chuck Lindbergh, a man not much given to sentiment, would remember it as a big wave of noise washing over them. It gave him a happy chill, the likes of which he'd never experienced before or since. Robert McElDowney of Roanoke, Illinois, had watched the patrol's ascent from the landing beach. Now he joined the wild hooting and yelling as he savored the crowning moment. "It was a thrill," he said. "When they put that flag up, I'll never forget. The entire island erupted with cheers. It sent a chill up and down my spine." Max Heffley watched, too, through his binoculars. "It felt great," he said. "When the flag went up, there was a lot of noise all over the island." Many of the young Marines, in their giddiness, assumed that the Battle of Iwo Jima was over. In this, they were drastically mistaken. Robert Leader was one combatant who did not make this assumption. Amid the jubilation, he experienced a chill of a darker sort than Lindbergh's or McElDowney's. "When I saw the flag, I thought it was a bad idea for us up there," he remembered. "It was like sitting in the middle of a bullseye." Leader's misgivings quickly proved prophetic. Just moments after the Stars and Stripes went up, Hot Rocks' summit got hot again. The first Japanese emerged from his tunnel with his back to the Marines. Harold Keller spotted him at once and fired his rifle 3 times from the hip. The fallen figure was yanked back into the hole from where he'd come. Another sniper immediately popped up and aimed his rifle at the Marines. Chick Robeson gunned him down. Next was a maddened Japanese officer who leaped into view with a broken sword. An alert Marine dropped him. Now the crater briefly came alive with ordnance. The serpent was not completely dead after all. Hand grenades started to arc out of several enemy caves. The Marines took cover and began hurling grenades of their own. Photographer Lou Lowry was standing near the flag when a Japanese soldier stuck his head out of a cave and lobbed a grenade. Lowry dove over the volcano's rim and rolled and slid about 40 feet down the steep, jagged side before he could break his fall. He suffered several cuts to his flesh, but was not seriously injured. His camera was broken, but his film was safe. Lowry decided it was time to head back down to find another camera. The firefight lasted several minutes, and no American casualties were taken. And then the invisible enemy was silent once again. After things had settled down, some of the young Marines grew fascinated with the view down below. Donald Howell found a working pair of large artillery field glasses amazingly intact in the rubble. He propped them up on their tripod, gazed through them, and was startled by what he could see. "They gave you an amazing view of the beaches," he recalled. "They, the Japanese, could see our every move." When 18-year-old James Buchanan had his turn, the war fell away for a moment, and he was taken with boyish wonder. "I looked through them and could see all of Iwo. It was beautiful." For others, the morning exacted grimmer duties. Chuck Lindbergh remembered that he and his comrades spent the ensuing hours securing the mountain. "We used the flamethrowers or demolition charges for the caves we couldn't walk into, and we walked into whatever caves we could. We burned them out. We didn't know what side the Japanese would be coming up from, so we had to work fast." Only later would the Marines comprehend just how much danger still festered inside Suribachi on the morning of February 23rd. Rummaging through an open cave for souvenirs a few days afterward, Lindbergh and Chick Robeson uncovered a sickening sight: the bodies of at least 150 Japanese freshly dead. They had died of self-inflicted wounds. "The stench was so foul that we had to put on gas masks," Robeson recalled. "We went in with a small flashlight and found it to be a large cave in 2 parts. Dead Japanese lay all about, so thick we had to tread on some. Many had died by holding grenades to their stomachs." "Why these Japanese hadn't tried to bolt from the cave and overwhelm the flag-raising patrol is a mystery," Robeson continued. "They had our men outnumbered 4 to 1. What made the situation even more unaccountable was that there were other occupied caves on the summit. We'll never know the number of Japanese who could have hurled themselves against our patrol. but there were surely enough to have killed every man in it. There is one persuasive explanation for those self-annihilated soldiers, and it speaks to the corruption of Bushido that was wrought by Japan's malignant military regime. A traditional samurai might expect to die in combat and be honored for it. He might kill himself to atone for a moral mistake or a failure of courage. But suicide as an expression of ultimate sacrifice for one's country was not a traditional samurai value. This was a construct of a deranged military establishment cynically bent on extracting the maximum utility from its isengorin. While the 3rd Platoon was taking control of Suribachi's summit, other things were going on down below. The Secretary of the Navy, James Forrestal, had decided the previous night that he wanted to go ashore and witness the final stage of the fight for the mountain. Now, under a stern commitment to take orders from Howland Mad Smith, the Secretary was churning ashore in the company of the blunt, earthy general. Their boat touched the beach just after the flag went up, and the mood among the high command turned jubilant. Gazing upward at the red, white, and blue speck, Forrestal remarked to Smith, "Holland, the raising of that flag on Suribachi means a Marine Corps for the next 500 years. Forrestal was so taken with the fervor of the moment that he decided he wanted the Suribachi flag as a souvenir. The news of this wish did not sit well with Chandler Johnson, whose temperament was every bit as fiery as Howland Mad's. "The hell with that!" the colonel spat when that message reached him. The flag belonged to the battalion, as far as Johnson was concerned. He decided to secure it as soon as possible and dispatched his assistant operations officer, Lieutenant Ted Tuttle, to the beach to scare up a replacement flag. As an afterthought, Johnson called after Tuttle, "And make it a bigger one!" At about this same time, a short, nearsighted, mustachioed wire service photographer named Joe Rosenthal was struggling through a bad morning indeed. Rosenthal, covering the invasion for the Associated Press, had landed on Iwo at around noon on D-Day and had risked his life to get stirring action shots through the days of combat that followed. But on the morning of February 23rd, nothing seemed to go right for him. He slipped on a wet ladder and fell into the ocean between the command ship and a landing craft. Fished out, he unzipped his camera, a bulky and durable speed graphic, from its waterproof bag and clicked off a shot of Forrestal and Smith looking resolutely toward the beach. As he was approaching Iwo Jima in an LCT in the company of Bill Hipple, a magazine correspondent, the bosun told Rosenthal he had just heard on his radio that a patrol was climbing Suribachi. "The hell you say," Hipple said. "That's what I heard," the sailor said. Hipple and Rosenthal headed toward the mountain, being careful to avoid marked mines, until they reached the command post of the 28th Regiment. There they encountered two Marines who were also combat photographers, Private Bob Campbell, who worked with a still camera, and Sergeant Bill Ganost, who had a movie camera loaded with color film. "I think we'll be too late for the flag raising," Ganost remarked. But Rosenthal had come too far to turn back. "I'd still like to go up," he said, and talked Campbell and Ganost, who were armed, into making the ascent with him. The three men shouldered their cameras and hit the steep trail. While Lieutenant Tuttle was off searching for a replacement flag, Chandler Johnson decided that Lieutenant Schreier up on the mountain could use a wired connection with the base for his field telephone, whose battery signal was growing weak. He rang up Dave Severance at Easy Company and ordered a detail to reel out a phone wire. The 2nd Platoon had just trooped in from its probe around the mountain's base. Severance ordered Mike, Harlan, Ira, and Franklin to the battalion command post to tie in a telephone wire that the fire team would then unreel up the mountain. Strank said simply, "Let's go." The boys were tired, but nobody asked the young sergeant where they were going. Nobody complained. As Ira later wrote, "We were certainly uneasy." The captain also dispatched his runner, 19-year-old Rene Gagnon, to the command post for fresh SCR-300 batteries for Schreier. They reached Colonel Johnson's field headquarters just as Lieutenant Tuttle hurried into view. He was carrying an American flag that he had obtained from LST-779 on the beach. As it happened, this flag, which at 96 by 56 inches was a good deal larger than the one now planted on the mountain, had been found in a salvage yard at Pearl Harbor, rescued from a sinking ship, on that date which will live in infamy. Tuttle handed the flag to Chandler Johnson, who in turn gave it to Renee to put inside his field pack. "When you get to the top," the colonel told Mike, "you tell Schreier to put this flag up, and I want him to save the small flag for me." With their cargo of telephone wire, batteries, and American flag, the five boys set off up the mountain, unreeling the wire as they climbed. Doc had remained atop the mountain. They reached the rim around noon. Mike reported to Lieutenant Schreier and explained the delivery of wire and batteries and Johnson's desire to preserve the first flag. As Renee handed Mike the replacement flag, the sergeant decided an explanation was in order. "Colonel Johnson wants this big flag run up high," he told the lieutenant, "so every son of a bitch on this whole cruddy island can see it." Mike directed Ira and Franklin to look for a length of pipe. He and Harlan started clearing a spot for planting the pole, and Harlan began stacking stones. On his descent from the crater, Lowry encountered Joe Rosenthal, Bill Ganost, and Bob Campbell picking their way upward. Lowry told the group that he'd photographed the flag raising. The three photographers considered turning around and heading back, but Lowry had a different idea. "You should go on up there," he said. "There's a hell of a good view of the harbor." The three photographers trudged on. A good view of a different sort greeted Rosenthal when he reached the summit, a little after noon. The American flag in close-up snapping in the strong breeze. "I tell you, I still get this feeling of a patriotic jolt when I recall seeing our flag flying up there," he told an interviewer some years later. Then Rosenthal spotted another interesting sight toward the far side of the crater, a couple of Marines hauling an iron pole toward another Marine who was holding a second American flag neatly folded. Rosenthal's fingers instinctively went to his speed graphic. Maybe he would get a flag-raising photograph after all. The pole that Ira and Franklin were dragging was a length of drainage pipe that weighed more than 100 pounds. As they approached the site, Lieutenant Schreier suggested that Mike's team do the job. The lieutenant wanted the replacement flag raised simultaneously with the lowering of the first one. Mike attached the flag to the pole. Schreier rounded up some Marines to lower the first pole, and then stood between the two clusters of flag groups, directing them. The three photographers milled about some distance away near the volcano's outer rim. Each of the three looked for a good vantage point. Campbell walked away and moved into position a short distance down the hillside, almost directly below the first flag, so that he could shoot upward at it as the Marines took it down. Ganost, almost shoulder to shoulder with Rosenthal, about 30 yards from the second flag, had a few feet of color film left in his camera and decided to wait for the right moment to use them. The 5'5" Rosenthal had put down his speed graphic and was bent over, piling up stones and a sandbag to stand on and improve his shooting angle. His camera was set at a speed of 1/400th of a second, with the f-stop between 8 and 16. No one else on the summit paid much attention to what was going on. The action had all the significance of a new football being tossed into a game in progress. It all happened in seconds. Ganost's movie camera recorded it all. In the solitude of my living room, I have watched those few seconds again and again in slow motion. Here is how it unfolded. Harlan braced himself above the target spot in the rubble-strewn ground, ready to receive the base of the pole. Mike, at the other end, in charge, guided it toward him, the pipe over his right shoulder. Mike held a large flag wrapped around the pole to keep it from fluttering in the strong wind until the pole was planted. Mike and his four squad members circled closer to the pole. They raised their feet high with each step to get clear of the debris. It looked as if they were walking in deep snow. Ira walked toward the pole facing Mike, his back to Ganost's camera frame. He said something to Mike that was lost in the strong wind. Ira was wearing his Indian-style blanket stuffed through his military belt on his rump. Mike saw Doc Bradley walking past with a load of bandages in his arms and asked him to come and help. Doc dropped the bandages and moved to the pole, directly between Mike and Harlan. Franklin walked to the pole from the foreground of Ganost's camera frame. Renee approached the group from behind to the right, his rifle slung over his shoulder. He stood behind my father, who was in front of the pole in the movie frame. The boys converged in a cluster behind Harlan, who bent low at the base. Doc gripped the pole in the cluster's center. Rosenthal spotted the movement and grabbed his camera. Ganost, about 3 feet from Rosenthal, asked, "I'm not in your way, am I, Joe?" "Oh, no," Rosenthal answered. As he later remembered, I turned from him, and out of the corner of my eye, I said, "Hey, Bill, there it goes." He swung his camera and clicked off a frame. In that same instant, the flagpole rose upward in a quick arc. The banner, released from Mike's grip, fluttered out in the strong wind. Rosenthal remembers, "By being polite to each other, we both damn near missed the scene. I swung my camera around and held it until I could guess that this was the peak of the action and shot. And then it was over. The flag was up. Campbell had gotten the shot he was after, the first flag going down in the foreground of his frame and the second one going up off in the distance. Ganost had gotten the footage he wanted, a routine, spontaneous color sequence of the replacement flag raising. Only Joe Rosenthal was unsure. The AP man didn't even have a chance to glimpse the image in his viewfinder. Of course, he later said, I couldn't positively say I had the picture. It's something like shooting a football play. You don't brag about it until it's developed. He'd captured 1/400th of a second out of 4 seconds of fluid motion. He had no idea whether he'd gotten a blur, a shot of the sky, or a passable photograph. The six continued to struggle with the heavy pole in the whipping wind. The pole was fully upright. Harlan raised his hands up the pole and gripped it, baseball bat style, using his weight to force it into the ground. Ira did the same. Then Franklin added his heft. Mike anchored things. Within a few more seconds, the flagpole was freestanding, the cloth snapping and cracking in the wind. After a moment, Franklin and some of the others began looking for rocks to add support. Doc offered ropes he'd brought along to tie casualties to stretchers, and they secured the pole. No one paid attention. It was just a replacement flag. The important flag, the first one raised that day, was brought down the mountain and presented to Colonel Johnson, who stored it in the battalion safe. It bore too much historic value for the battalion to be left unguarded atop Suribachi. The replacement flag flew for 3 weeks, eventually chewed up by the strong wind. A few moments after the raising, Joe Rosenthal did what Lowry had done a couple of hours before him. He called several Marines over to cluster around the pole for a standard posed gung-ho shot. Lieutenant Schreier helped gather a crowd of boys for this photograph. Mike, Ira, Doc, Franklin, and 14 other Marines posed proudly beneath the flag, waving their arms, rifles, and helmets. Ira Hayes is smiling in this shot, his face creased with a wide, happy grin. He is the only seated figure among the 18. Mike is standing next to Lieutenant Schreier. His lips are puckered as if he is yelling a joyous hoo-ah. Franklin and Doc are behind Mike, one peering over each of his broad shoulders. Franklin has a triumphant smile and is thrusting his carbine in the air. Doc Bradley would later say, "We were happy, and in this shot he looks it." He has a big smile as he waves his helmet with his right hand. Joe Rosenthal was satisfied with this posed shot. He felt certain that with all these smiling young boys facing the camera and the landing beaches visible below, he had a photograph that would make the papers back home. But the AP photographer would have to wait several days before he knew. That night, his film was flown to Guam for developing. If there were any good shots, they would be transmitted by radio signal to New York. Several months later, the 2nd Battalion filed its action report for its role in the Battle of Iwo Jima. In describing the events of February 23rd, the report covered the reconnaissance patrol of the early morning. It covered Easy Company's 15-man patrol around the southern tip of the island, the 2nd Platoon. It covered Lieutenant Schreier's expedition up Suribachi with the 40-man patrol from Easy and the planting of the first American flag at 10:20 a.m., It mentioned the blowing up of caves, the recovery of the Japanese binoculars, the sporadic resistance by fleeing Japanese. The action report made no mention of a second flag raising. It was, after all, only a replacement flag. Chapter 12. Myths. Here's one for all time. John Bodkin, the AP photo editor in Guam. The exhausted conquerors of Mount Suribachi spent the ensuing 4 days resting on the brittle skin of the dead serpent. Some explored and blew out caves and tunnels. Some wrote letters home. They had beaten the mountain, and so they thought the battle was over for them. At least they were safe, or safer than they had been for nearly 100 hours. They had to be alert for the occasional Japanese infiltrator who prowled by night, but now the Japanese were mainly destroying themselves and one another. At night, the boys listened to this morbid business being conducted below them in the hollowed-out 7 stories of Suribachi. As we lay in our foxholes trying to sleep, we could hear them blowing themselves up with grenades held to their stomachs, remembered Chick Robeson. Joe Rosenthal's pack of film from February 23rd, with its 12 exposures, together with the pack he had started shooting the day before, began to work its way through the military channels back to America. First, it was tossed into a mail plane headed for the base at Guam, 1,000 miles south across the Pacific. There, the film would pass through many hands, any of which could consign it to a wastebasket. Technicians from a pool lab would develop it. Their mistakes were routinely tossed aside. Then censors would scrutinize it, and finally the pool chief would look at each print to decide which was worth transmitting back to the United States via radio photo and which to discard. Of the 12 exposures from the pack taken on the 23rd, 2 were ruined by streaks from light that had leaked through the camera housing onto the film. These 2 were adjacent to the 10th frame, the one Rosenthal had clicked off without looking into the viewfinder. For some reason, the light hadn't marred that one. 3 days after the flag raising, my father found time to write home. He mentioned his concern for his brother Jim, then fighting in Europe, and for his father, who had suffered a heart attack. But for the sake of his worried mother, this 22-year-old, caught in one of history's most ferocious battles, was only reassuring. Iwo Jima, February 26, 1945. Dear Mother, Dad, and all, I just have time for a line or two. I want to tell you I'm in the best of health. You know all about our battle out here, and I was with the victorious Company E, 2nd Battalion, 28th Marines, who reached the top of Mount Suribachi first. I had a little to do with raising the American flag, and it was the happiest moment of my life. I have been worried about Dad. I hope he is out of the hospital and up around again. I imagine you were a bit worried because you didn't hear from me. I can't write very often, so please don't be alarmed if you don't receive mail frequently. I hope the news from Jim is for the best and that you're all in good health and happy. About an hour after we reached the top of the mountain, our Catholic chaplain had Mass and I went to Holy Communion. I sure did my share of praying, and it really gave me much security. I'd give my left arm for a good shower and a clean shave. I have a 6-day beard. Haven't had any soap or water since I hit the beach. I never knew I could go without food, water, or sleep for 3 days, but I know now it can be done. I'll write a longer letter when I get the chance. Good luck, and give everyone my regards. Your loving son, Jack. 17-year-old Chick Robeson more accurately described the fear all of them must have felt. I was never scared so stiff in my life before. When the Japanese mortars and artillery starts dropping, I just can't help but shake like I was freezing, but I guess everybody else does the same thing. Franklin wrote to Goldie, offering her a harrowing kind of reassurance that she shouldn't worry, even though bullets had been whizzing through his clothes. Iwo Jima, February 27, 1945. Dearest Mother, as you probably already know, we hit Iwo Jima February 19th, just a week ago today. My regiment took the hill with our company on the front line. The hill was hard, and I sure never expected war to be like it was those first 4 days. I got some through my clothing, and I sure am happy that I am still okay. This island is practically secured. There is some heavy fighting on one end, and we are bothered some at night. Mother, you can never imagine how a battlefield looks. It sure looks horrible. Look for my picture because I helped put the flag up. Please don't worry. And write. Your son, Franklin Sousley, U.S. Marine. Like Rosenthal, Franklin hoped the posed gung-ho shot in which he appeared would make the papers back home. And Renee took a moment from his rounds to jot a note to his sweetheart, Pauline Harnois. Now that I can tell you, I was in action on Iwo Jima, and that is the reason for such a delay in writing. I am still fine, and some of my buddies are still with me. Some are dead or wounded. After seeing all this, it makes me realize what freedom really means. I got your pictures with the evening gown aboard ship, so I put them in my helmet and carried them with me. They're not banged up too much. You still look beautiful, darling. The Marines on Suribachi could not know it, but Americans back home were following their every move. Iwo Jima had become the number one front page story in newspapers across the country, and it had become the most heavily covered written about battle in World War II. Readers who just days before had never heard of the Sulphur Island were by now as familiar with its contours as with their own backyards. As the war in Europe was thundering to an end, correspondents had migrated from that theater to the Pacific to record the growing conflict. Their dispatches flooded the newspapers, which churned out extra editions and radio bulletins. Movie theaters showed newsreels of the assault, sometimes updating them daily as new footage arrived. For the first time in history, the radio networks carried live broadcasts from a beachhead under fire. The news was stunningly fresh. In all invasions before Iwo, news copy had hitchhiked back to America on whatever transportation was available. Usually it had been flown to Honolulu on hospital planes evacuating the wounded. In this haphazard system, newsmen first had to wait until an airstrip was clear to accommodate the aircraft. Then they had to see that their dispatches made it aboard a plane. After that, they could only hope the material would reach Navy Press headquarters once the aircraft landed at Pearl Harbor. It was a time-consuming process. Often days went by before news hit the home front. Tarawa's three-day battle was over before the first on-the-spot account of the fighting reached the mainland. Fully 8 days had elapsed after the Saipan invasion before the first photo reached the U.S. But at Iwo Jima, the process was accelerated and streamlined. Daily editions during the week of February 19th brought battle accounts within 24 hours of actual time. Papers told the story in bold headlines, pages of background stories and numerous maps and diagrams. Suddenly, civilians clustered in coffee shops and gathered around water coolers were bantering expertly, tossing off terms such as Green Beach, Suribachi, and Kurabayashi with ease. Their expertise was formed abruptly. There had been no advance hint that an invasion of this magnitude was brewing. Iwo Jima burst onto the front page of the New York Times on Monday, February 19th, under the bold lead headline, U.S. Marines Storm Ashore on Iwo Island. On the following day and for the rest of the week, Iwo Jima remained the number one news story. Tuesday's main headline in the Times blared, Marines fight way to airfield on Iwo Isle, win 2 mile beachhead, 800 ships aid landing. Below this appeared an enlarged photo of Iwo Jima with 18 strategic points identified. The dominant feature was Mount Suribachi, festooned with an artist's rendering of a Japanese flag sitting atop it. It hardly seemed to matter that General Patton was racing across Germany or that President Roosevelt was sailing back from a historic summit conference in the Crimea. All other news was secondary to that from Iwo. Wednesday's headline offered a hint of triumph. Marines conquer airfield, hold third of Iwo. This was tempered a bit by General Holland M. Smith's somber front-page quote that made plain the scale of the bloodletting. The fight is the toughest we've run across in 168 years. On Thursday, the banner headline brought sobering news. Marines halted on Iwo, near first airfield. And on page 4 of the New York Times, in an article headlined Marines' Hardest Fight, the grisly statistics began to unspool. Now the Marines have come to their hardest battle, a battle still unwon. Our first waves on Iwo were almost wiped out. 3,650 Marines were dead, wounded, or missing after only 2 days of fighting on the most heavily defended island in the world, more than the total casualties of Tarawa, about as many as all the Marine casualties of Guadalcanal in the 5 months of jungle combat. Americans recoiled. This was worse than anything their boys had suffered in World War II, worse than Tarawa, worse than Normandy, worse than on the beachhead at Anzio. There was no doubt that the Marines were in the bloodiest battle since Gettysburg. The statistics were staggering. Ewell's 4 days of fighting worse than Guadalcanal's 5 months. It was as though Babe Ruth's 60-homer season had been eclipsed in one game. The news text may have accelerated in its race around the globe, but in 1945 it still took news wire photos 2 extra days to complete the journey. Thus, the hopeful Times headline of Friday, February 23rd, "Marines Take Suribachi, Chief Point on Ewu," was not accompanied by any photos of the seizure. Readers must have been heartened as the news proclaimed, "Volcano was seized, Marines put flag atop Suribachi's crest." But any joy was tempered by, "Japanese hit back, our casualties at 5,372. Saturday, February 24th, brought a still more sobering headline, "Marines gain slowly in center of Ewu." Americans must have gone to sleep that Saturday night with heavy hearts. Normandy had been a wrenching experience. On the other hand, the beaches were captured in just a day. The casualties there had not been as heavy as on Ewu, and the reader was comforted by the knowledge of a quick victory. But the Pacific's largest D-Day was terribly different. 5 days of unthinkable casualties filled each morning's headlines. Americans combed the columns for a hint of hope. The sudden wave of uncertainty in the Pacific, so hard upon the triumphal news from Europe, created a sickening anxiety. And then, as unexpectedly as the news of the invasion itself, a radiant image of victory burned its way around the curve of the earth. One of the first to notice it was John Bodkin, the AP photo editor in Guam. On a routine night in his bureau office, he casually picked up a glossy print of the replacement photograph. He looked at it. He paused, shook his head in wonder, and whistled. "Here's one for all time," he exclaimed to the bureau at large. Then, without wasting another second, he radio-photoed the image to AP headquarters in New York at 7 a.m. Eastern wartime. Soon afterward, wire photo machines in newsrooms across the country were picking up the AP image. Newspaper editors, accustomed to sorting through endless battle photographs, would cast an idle glance at it, then stand fascinated. "Lead photo, page one, above the fold," they would bark. News pros were not the only ones bedazzled by the photo. Navy Captain T.B. Clark was on duty at Patuxent Air Station in Virginia that Saturday when it came humming off the wire. He studied it for a moment, then thrust it under the gaze of Navy Petty Officer Felix de Welden. De Welden was an Austrian immigrant schooled in European painting and sculpture. He was assigned to Patuxent Studios to paint a mural of the Battle of the Coral Sea. De Welden could not take his eyes off the photo. In its classic triangular lines, he recognized similarities with the great ancient statues he had studied. He reflexively reached for some sculptor's clay and tools. With the photograph before him, he labored through the long night. By dawn, he had replicated the 6 boys pushing a pole, raising a flag. The next morning, Sunday, February 25th, millions of Americans were similarly transfixed by the image. People would always remember where they were the moment they saw the photo, as others would later remember President Kennedy's death. The flag-raising photograph signaled victory and hope. A counterpoint to the photos of sinking ships at Pearl Harbor that had signaled defeat and fear 4 years earlier. Men and women bent down sleepily to their doorsteps, took one look, and called back into the house, "Hey, look at this!" City pedestrians handed 3 cents to a street news vendor, took a few steps, then turned back and bought another copy. Charles Sweeney, who later dropped the atomic bomb on Nagasaki, would write that his Catholic mother allowed only 2 images to be hung on the family's dining room wall, Jesus and FDR. Until the morning she saw the flag photo, that is. She framed it and hung it as the revered 3rd icon on the wall. Many a mother with a son in the Pacific wondered if her boy was in the photo. But for Harlan's mother, Belle, back in Weslaco, Texas, there was no doubt. She was sure. Early that morning, Harlan's brother, Ed Block, Jr., home on leave from the Air Force, stepped onto the family porch and stooped to retrieve the Sunday edition of the Weslaco Mid-Valley News. He had just sat down in an easy chair in the living room and lifted the paper in front of him when Belle breezed into the room. As she passed behind him, she glanced at the paper. Then she stopped. She leaned over Ed's right shoulder, put her finger on the figure in the photo, thrusting the pole into the ground, and exclaimed, "Look at there, Junior! There's your brother Harlan!" Ed did a double take, looking hard at the photo. The figure Belle was pointing to was unidentifiable, just the back of a Marine with no side view. The caption read only, "Old Glory Goes Up Over Iwu," and the articles provided no names. "Mama," Ed declared, "there's no way you can know that's Harlan. That's just the back of a Marine. And besides, we don't even know Harlan is on Iwo Jima." "Oh, that's definitely Harlan," Belle insisted as she slid the paper from Ed's grasp. And as she strode into the kitchen, her eyes fixed on the photo, Ed could hear her saying, "I know my boy." The photograph's impact spread like a shockwave. That same Sunday, February 25th, the columnist for the New York Times launched into a piece devoted to the most beautiful picture of the war. A writer for the Times Union of Rochester, New York, home of Eastman Kodak, and a city where the visual vocabulary of photography was a familiar language, proclaimed the image a masterpiece comparable to Leonardo's Last Supper. The receptionists at major newspapers reported something unusual the week of the photo's appearance. Their switchboards were jammed with callers seeking reprints. Soon, publishers were issuing special extra editions, one featuring the photograph in color, while another promised printed on heavy paper suitable for framing. They couldn't print enough. All sold out. No one knew who the flag raisers were, but Joe Rosenthal was an instant celebrity. On February 27th, the Times ran a huge photo of Joe, identifying him as the photographer who has earned nationwide praise for his picture. Mr. A.B. R. Shelley of Raleigh, North Carolina, saw the photo and immediately wrote a letter to the editor of the Times, who published it on February 28th. On the front page of the Times of February 25th is a picture which should make a magnificent war memorial. It is the picture of the Marines of the 5th Division raising Old Glory atop Mount Suribachi. There are war statues aplenty, but most of them are fictional. Reproduced in bronze, this actual scene should make good art and a fitting tribute to American men and American valor. By national consensus, it was a beautiful image. But for those who wanted facts, what exactly did it represent? No one suspected it, but the photograph suggested a very different reality from that being experienced by the Marines back on Iwo Jima. On the same day the replacement photo appeared in the U.S., Boots Thomas was summoned from his battle post to General Smith's command ship. There, he was interviewed by a CBS radio correspondent. The interviewer didn't touch upon the Rosenthal photograph. He had not learned of its existence. Even if he had, he would not have brought it up. After all, it was only a replacement flag raising. It held no significance to those on Iwo Jima. To everyone on the island, the flag raising referred only to the one Boots was involved in. In his interview, Boots told the modest truth. His patrol walked up the volcano slope, encountering no opposition, and put up a flag as photographer Lowry recorded the scene. But a number of elements came together to create an altogether different set of perceptions for the folks back home. First, thousands had cheered the initial flag raising atop Suribachi, but from a distance. Only a few were close enough to see exactly who the raisers were. No one paid attention to or cheered the replacement flag raising, and no one cared who raised it. For most of the Marines on the island, there was only one flag raising. Second, because civilian Rosenthal's AP photos traveled faster than Marine Lowry's military photos, only one flag raising was represented in the papers back home. Third, because the replacement flag raising was essentially a non-event, little was said about it. So readers back home assumed there was only one flag raising, the one they beheld on the front pages of their newspapers. Fourth, reporters safe on ships miles from Suribachi and editors half a world away not only failed to report the full range of facts, they inadvertently created a confusing myth about the flag raisings that continues to this day. There was the matter of that almost mythical image of the mountain. Nearly all aerial photographs featured Mount Suribachi. Maps highlighted it, and news reports emphasized the enemy fire raining down from it. Thus, even though the rocky northern end of the island would prove to be the costliest part of the battle, it was natural for the reader to assume that once Mount Suribachi, the high point on the island, was taken, the battle would quickly end. Then there was the shifting emphasis of reportage as the assault on the volcano wound down. The distant reporters had lavished great detail on the fierce fighting that led the Marines to the base of the mountain. Then they added 3 days of fanciful and garbled accounts of a murderous fight up Suribachi's slopes, but they never mentioned the actual quiet walk up Suribachi on that Friday morning of February 23rd. On that day, lacking any supporting photos of the conquest, the editors substituted a photograph of Marines pinned down on a hill far to the north. This only added to the false impression that Marines had been pinned down on Suribachi's slopes. On Saturday, February 24th, the day after the flag raisings and the day before the photo appeared, correspondents continued to embellish the myth of the Battle of Suribachi. Suribachi reached in a fiery battle. Way to volcano's base burned with flamethrowers prior to scaling of volcano. Ascent made by Marines as Japanese hurled grenades and poured bullets on them. The boys of Easy Company would have howled at these gross exaggerations, but the Times copy just kept it up. Suribachi was the devil incarnate, seeping steam and volcanic fumes, and the Japanese were rolling grenades down the steep, tawny cliffs to burst in the faces of advancing Marines, as the embattled Marines called for ropes and stretchers to lower the wounded over the sharp cliffs. These were the myths and inaccuracies that shaped Americans' perceptions of the battle in the days before the photograph appeared. When it did spring into the nation's consciousness on that Sunday morning, the photograph fused with the accumulated myth and seemed to depict a final triumph in the very teeth of battle. The Times was not through yet. It continued to fan the flames of hilltop heroism with a report that Boots Thomas broke out the ensign, which was about 3 feet long, while his company was under intense enemy sniper fire. How to explain this travesty of accuracy? How could an unopposed 45-minute climb up a hill and a quiet flag-raising be portrayed as a valiant fight to the death? The Marines were not to blame. None were quoted as sources, and none have since been blamed for the misleading hyperbole. Quite simply, the press faltered in its duty. It replaced reportage with romanticism. Carried away by the daily valor of the Marines working at a safe but obfuscating distance and swept up in its own fantasy of a swashbuckling fight for a mountain, reporters invented the heroic fight up the slopes and the flag raising among whizzing bullets out of whole cloth. In later months and years, when the myth was found to be just that, other reporters focused their suspicions on the men on the mountain. Then a new myth, an anti-myth, took root, fanned by later complacent reporters who made no effort to root out the true story. The flag raising did not signify the end of the battle. It was just beginning. Easy Company's sector was secure, but no place was safe on the small island. Distant giant guns in the north showered the mountain with nerve-shattering nighttime shells. Dave Severance, hardly an officer given to panic, recalled one especially severe barrage. "It was my first experience with heavy artillery," he said, "and I was scared as hell. I crowded myself against the edge of the crater so hard that I gradually inched myself right up over the top." On Wednesday, February 28th, the 28th Marines received orders to prepare to move north. Their assignment was to relieve the 27th Marines at the 5th Division front on the heavily embattled west coast of the island. The order to leave the mountain quickly changed Easy's mood to one of apprehension. "My 21st birthday is coming up March 10th, Boots Thomas observed to a friend, "but I'll never see it." And on that evening, Tex Stanton dropped into a foxhole that he and Mike Strank had prepared a little while earlier. Mike was already there, and Stanton at once sensed something different about him. He was lying limp, hobo style, on his back, with his hands behind his head, Stanton remembered. And he was quiet. Now, Mike was always active, always talking, and I had never seen him still, so I asked, "What's the matter?" Mike answered, "Oh, nothing. I was just wondering where we're going with all this." Tex Stanton felt a chill. He was so affected that he jumped out of the foxhole. He was talking about his death, Tex maintained years later. Mike knew he was going to die. The northern battlefield beckoned. The idyll atop Suribachi was about to end. Harold Keller, looking through binoculars toward the fighting in the distance, summed up what Easy would face the next day. Asked later by a fellow Marine what he saw, Keller responded simply, "The Japs had all the cover, and our men got clobbered."
End of Disc 7.